This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this one's for you, all you children of the 80s. You are my people. All that big hair, spandex, those scrunchies, some absolutely epic music, and unfortunately, this.
I'm Dr. Michael Resnick with some bad news about the ozone.
This medical news update is brought to you by Advil, Advanced Medicine for Pain.
The ozone layer shields the Earth from the sun's ultraviolet rays. But a recent report concluded that this layer is thinning rapidly due to trace gases, primarily CFCs in consumer products.
You probably remember that. I do. The sudden realization that the ozone layer was in danger, something most of us had never even heard of prior to 1985. Skin cancer rates were going to skyrocket. Crops could fail. Ecosystems could collapse. It was an existential threat. One so urgent that I was one of those 10-year-olds who refused to crush a piece of styrofoam for fear of releasing more CFCs into the air. The story, though, starts even further back with two scientists, Sherwood Rowland and Mario Molina at the University of California, Irvine.
This started back in 1972 and 1973 with curiosity on the part of a laboratory chemist, namely me, about what would happen to the chlorofluorocarbon gases, which had just been discovered as being present in the atmosphere essentially everywhere. And so when Dr. Mario Molina joined my research group in 1973,
we decided to ask a question about some chemicals that were just being released to the environment, and we realized that they could pose a serious global environmental problem.
Chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs, first developed in the 1920s, and by mid-century used almost everywhere around the Earth, in aerosol sprays, as blowing agents for foams and packing materials, as solvents and refrigerants. Molina and Rowland discovered these chemicals could reach the upper atmosphere and destroy the ozone layer, which provides vital protection from excess ultraviolet radiation from the sun. They published their results in 1974, and not much happened. But they knew this was serious. Rowland's wife, Joan, spoke about it in a PBS documentary.
Sherry, who was my husband, a very good husband, I might add, came home one night, and I was in bed reading, and I said, you know, how's the work going? And he said, it's going really well. The only trouble is, I think it's the end of the world.
Rowland decided to take action. He advocated loudly and publicly throughout the 1970s.
To avoid these hazards, man cannot continue his ever-increasing use of these chemicals. Instead, we must rapidly reduce in the future the amounts of these materials released into the atmosphere.
It wasn't long before other scientists validated their findings. And in 1985, a team of British scientists, including Jonathan Shanklin, discovered something alarming. A giant hole in the ozone over Antarctica. Here's Shanklin from a Nature podcast.
Each spring, over Antarctica, a hole in the ozone develops.
Satellite photos show that a hole opens for a few months during Antarctica's springtime.
It was very clear when we first looked at the data that we've got an ozone decline. And I think that's probably the term we use, a decline in ozone above the Antarctic. And it wasn't really until you got the satellite images you could say, oh, there's a hole there.
Soon after, the United States sent a team to Antarctica, led by Susan Solomon of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
From the time when the ozone hole was discovered in 1985 to, say, 1987, you went from a situation where you first had one station measuring total ozone showing something strange. And that was an intense period of activity for many of us in the science community. And we were able to measure a host of important chemicals that were all related to this, to the chemical perturbations I've been talking about. And they all pointed the same way.
They were pointing the way to the man-made destruction of the ozone layer. So, faced with what could fairly be described as impending catastrophe, countries around the world took action. In 1987, more than 30 nations signed the Montreal Protocol, an international treaty which focused on phasing out harmful CFCs.
It's being called an unprecedented display of international cooperation to protect the world's environment. The Montreal Protocol, signed today, aims at stopping the deterioration of the ozone layer in the atmosphere.
It was an historic agreement. To this day, the most successful international environmental treaty ever, as noted by then Secretary of State George Shultz to PBS.
When it was all done and the Montreal Protocol was signed, I remember President Reagan saying, "What a magnificent achievement."
It was a first step, but it wasn't long before every country in the world had signed on. That has never happened before for an international treaty, and it hasn't happened since. It was an environmental and diplomatic success. Signed 35 years ago, the Montreal Protocol did what it set out to do. Countries eliminated CFC use, and now the ozone layer is on the road to recovery. Just recently,
the ozone layer is on track to recover within 4 decades. In a new report, a UN-backed scientific panel confirmed that the phase-out of nearly 99% of banned ozone-depleting substances has succeeded in safeguarding the ozone layer, leading to a notable recovery of the ozone layer in the upper stratosphere and decreased human exposure to harmful ultraviolet rays from the sun.
And that is from a new United Nations report released earlier this month. So congratulations, humanity! You did it! We did it! We actually got together and solved, hopefully, knock on wood, we still do it, a major environmental, specifically atmospheric, global challenge. We averted catastrophe. So obviously the question is, how did that happen? And can those lessons be used for our current atmospheric global catastrophe, namely climate change? So that's what we're going to look at today. And we are honored to be joined by Paul Newman. He's chief scientist for Earth Sciences at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. Since 2007, he's co-chaired the scientific assessment panel to the Montreal Protocol. And every 4 years, he and his team drafts reports on the state of ozone depletion. Paul Newman, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Meghna.
So, first of all, I actually just want to dwell in a little bit of more history with you, Paul, if I could. Could you take us back to those early days where, you know, after the first reports out of UC Irvine, when there was initial satellite data coming out about the state of the ozone? Like, what's the story of what was going on in the scientific community when that first data emerged?
Well, let me talk a little bit. It was in, as you already, listening to Sherry Rowland and Mario Molina again, it's really nice. Both have passed now. Listening to their voices, I mean, these were people who found a scientific problem and identified it. We had to learn more about it when they published their paper in 1974. And that moved along. The first reports of the ozone hole occurred in 1985, and that was, we listened to John Shanklin just a minute ago. His colleagues, Joe Farman, Brian Gardner, and John, showed that ozone was going down fast. Now, here at NASA, we had satellite images of it, but we were puzzled by these very, very low values we were seeing from the satellite measurements, and like all scientists, we didn't want to put those data out there because we thought, oh, we've done something wrong. But it turned out that actually the low value is right. And in fact, once we saw the Farman, Gardner, and Shanklin results from Halley Station in Antarctica, we knew that we were seeing very, very, these values we were measuring from satellite were correct. And it was amazingly a depletion of ozone that was continental in scale. It's just an astonishing thing to see it falling so rapidly in the station data, but then to see that it was continental in scale. Now, at the time, I was just a young scientist here at NASA Goddard, and I began to work with folks about what could be the possible cause. And, you know, there were actually three theories early on. Was it man-made chlorofluorocarbons that could be causing it? There was a theory about the solar cycle. Could it be variations in the sun? Could it be some natural meteorological variation that could be causing it? We didn't know that in 1985. And so at that time, I think it was actually a little bit frightening. You know, were we really destroying our ozone layer? I mean, it was in the measurements, in showing up through 1984, we're going down really fast over Antarctica. It was a little bit, I got to admit, you know, it was a few sleepless nights I had there. You know, you're working hard on the science, but you really don't know at that point. There were theories, but no answers.
So, Paul, I appreciate that you're talking about how it caused some sleepless nights, because in a sense, thankfully, now in 2023, we can look back and think about the quaint worries we had about the ozone in the 80s. But it was real. I mean, I mentioned how, like, it actually, like, became a central fixture of my childhood, like thinking about like, you know, going to McDonald's and not break. They had styrofoam containers for the burgers back then. So we have about 30 seconds before our first break. Can you just describe in a couple of quick words what the fears were? Like, could the depletion of the ozone layer have caused an end to the life on Earth as we know it?
Well, yeah, we use UV radiation to sterilize things. Fortunately, we have an ozone layer that screens that solar radiation. That's an amazing thing. It's a fundamental critical gas to life on the Earth's surface. So if ozone is depleted, UV radiation goes up. Not only do you get faster sunburns, more skin cancer, more cataracts, but crop yields began to go down. And that actually, to me, was one of the frightening aspects. What if you can't feed the planet?
Yeah. Well, Paul Newman joins us today. He's chief scientist for Earth Sciences at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. And we are talking about a global scientific and political success in stopping the depletion of the ozone layer and what we can learn from it. More in a moment. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking about a success, humanity's success in defending the ozone layer, in stopping the production of CFCs beginning in 1987, which has now resulted in the safeguarding of the ozone layer, as announced by the United Nations this month. So we're going to ask, what lessons can we learn from this success? And I'm joined today by Paul Newman. He's chief scientist for Earth Sciences at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. And Paul, so you had described that basically life on Earth was or could have been potentially threatened, right? Talking about the fear of crop failure around the world. Mm-hmm. You also mentioned, though, that, you know, for example, in 1985, there was that first question of, like, this anomalous satellite data, right, showing that big hole over Antarctica, even though there was considerable scientific research that had gone in before that about the effect of CFCs in the upper atmosphere. Okay. But we go from that to 1987, just a couple of years later, with the signing of the Montreal Protocol. So what changed in those 2 years that got the world to act with such unanimity?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Megha. First of all, there was some groundwork that had been laid. The Vienna Convention was signed in 1985. Now, the Vienna Convention, it was a really important agreement. It basically identified ozone depletion as a problem. we needed to protect the ozone layer. And it established what's called the Ozone Secretariat. This is a managerial organization for countries that were interested in this. And that secretariat began to hold regular meetings of countries. And the third thing it did, it established a scientific framework. You know, the idea of scientists collecting from around the world to work on things was new. Before that, you know, the United States had done their reports, the UK had done their reports, the Russians had done their reports. Nobody did this internationally. So it was a big step forward to do these international results. The second thing was there was a series of books that were written in 1985, and it's called Atmospheric Ozone 1985, and it's a huge set of volumes. And this really collected all the science together and fundamentally showed that ozone depletion was a problem. Now, the ozone hole came along, and actually it turns out that the problem was a heck of a lot worse than what we were predicting in this collective scientific wisdom, these volumes in Atmospheric Ozone 1986. So we found out that the problem was worse than we thought. But the science was of ozone depletion was solid enough where the countries of the world figured we better do something now. It could be worse because of the Antarctic. We better do something now.
Okay, so let me jump in here then. So the science was solid enough that the world decided we have to do something now. That seems to be, through my 2023 eyes, there's a gap there, right? Because I feel like there's an equivalent amount of scientific consensus about human-caused climate change now. And there has been some global consensus as well, but not nearly the amount that we saw when we got to the eventual signing on of every nation to the Montreal Protocol. So what's the difference between the two scenarios?
Well, I think you have to keep in mind that the original signatories to the Vienna Convention, there's only 28 countries that signed on to that. And I think the Montreal Protocol was something like 46 countries that initially signed on to that, far from the 198 countries that you needed. And so there was a good agreement amongst a lot of the developing nations who produced most of these chlorofluorocarbons, but it wasn't absolute at that time. And this is the importance. I mean, we talk about we have to do reports every 4 years on ozone. This is the importance of science continuing to move forward and solidify the results. We've seen this with the IPCC reports on climate change. They've been doing the same thing since the early 1990s. So there's real scientific progress in establishing exactly what is going on. This is crucial to actually doing any policy, is to know the specifics of what's going on and where we're headed.
Okay, so I want to talk a little bit more then about what went into eventually every nation on Earth later on signing on to Montreal. Because I think we can't underscore enough, we were asking for a massive change. I mean, like, right? Because CFCs, as I described earlier, were very ubiquitous in industry, in consumer goods. It wasn't as if we were just saying, "Oh, stop using one product." I mean, it was quite a change in how we operate that the Montreal Protocol was suggesting. Correct?
Yeah, I mean, CFCs were used in everything. You already mentioned the little foam containers you put your hamburgers in, but it was also used in building insulation. It was used in refrigerators. It was used in air conditioners. You went to the supermarket and your food is cold because they had CFCs running those refrigeration units there. All the trucks carrying around delivering frozen foods and everything, they're all using CFCs. Boy, when I was a young man, I had a car, it had an air conditioner, I used CFC car. It was really, really widely used on a huge number of things. So changing was a big deal. The one thing that they had going for them is there were a number of technologies that were available to replace CFCs. That was a big, big plus. And some were just drop-in substances. You could use a different kind of gas to create your foam insulation. So that was the really positive aspect. Now, not everything. In fact, had replacement technologies at the time. But I think the parties or the, you know, technologists, policymakers knew that if they implemented some rules, that engineers and technologists would begin to change how we did things as an industrial society. And in fact, that's exactly what happened.
Okay. I apologize for jumping in here, Paul. Your line keeps dropping out every couple of minutes for a second or two. I just want to acknowledge that for listeners who are wondering what's going on. We were all wondering, wouldn't NASA have better internet than it does? But that's okay. I think it was DuPont that was the world's largest producer of CFCs. I think that's the part you might have dropped out at?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So DuPont, one of the major manufacturers, they actually, I believe it was their CEO, decided that, in fact, if it turned out that CFCs, in fact, were causing ozone depletion, DuPont was going to get out of the CFC business. And there was a scientist, his name was Mac McFarland, he was a DuPont scientist, he actually went before the CEO and said, indeed, this is what's going on. CFCs are depleting the ozone layer, and the CEO acted on that information. So a lot of credit goes to the CEO and Mac for actually standing up in front of all of the president and the vice president and the CEO and saying this ozone's being depleted by chlorofluorocarbons.
Okay. But it's not just one thing, right? I mean, it was the courageous actions of individuals like that. But then, as you were saying, also then being buttressed by this, you know, global international treaty and the consensus, it seems largely from, policy makers, including here in the United States. But I do recall, though, Paul, that you talked about there were other technologies available for to replace CFCs. But if I remember right, they weren't available, instantaneously, because I was looking at some old news reports from 1987, around the time, just after the United States was one of the signatories to Montreal. And in this ABC news report that I dug up, two issues were highlighted, including the fact that at that time, they were saying that there was no ready substitute for CFCs. So you're going to hear the voice of then EPA Administrator Lee Thomas and the voice of a spokesman from the Natural Resources Defense Council.
The problem, the EPA admits, is substitutes are not ready now.
We're a good ways from having substitutes that are equivalent. The 10-year time frame, we think, is sufficient time for development of those substitutes.
The EPA says a 50% reduction in 10 years' time will stop the destruction. Environmentalists disagree.
It won't even stop the buildup of these chemicals in the atmosphere. And ozone depletion, which is already going on, will continue and probably will get worse.
Paul Newman, can you respond to that criticism that you heard there from the NRDC back in 1987?
Well, in fact, every CFC molecule that you released was going to lead to ozone depletion. And in fact, we observed that emissions of CFCs began to fall immediately after 1987. And by so the growth rates of CFCs in our atmosphere began to slow down shortly after the Montreal Protocol was signed. And we saw that CFCs peaked in the atmosphere in the mid-1990s and began to fall off. So less than a decade after the signing of the Montreal Protocol, levels of CFCs in the atmosphere were on the decline. So they may have said that at the time, 10 years, but in fact it happened faster than 10 years. And certainly the production and consumption of CFCs fell off very quickly. Within a few years, it had substantially declined. I don't want to go back and re-legislate history, but what we see in the atmospheric observations that emissions stopped going up and the levels of CFCs began to decline in the mid-90s.
I played that because we're going to talk about a little in a few minutes about, lessons to be learned here, but I'm just trying to suss out sort of how many parallels there are between people, between, you know, policymakers' attitude, between how the scientific community acted back then, and also how the general public responded, including, you know, criticisms as well. So keep that in mind. But Paul, let's jump to the present day. Tell me briefly, in your mind, what is the current health of the planet's ozone? And, can we actually, in a couple of decades' time, will we be able to safely call it totally fixed?
The answer is yes and no. Mainly yes. It's a very capital yes. We're seeing ozone go down in the upper altitudes of the stratosphere. We're seeing improvements in the ozone hole as CFCs decline. And so we're seeing real response of the ozone layer to CFCs. You know, so remember, your first worry about emissions of CFCs going down, we saw that happen. We saw levels of chlorofluorocarbons and other gases called halons. They began to go down quite very rapidly after the signing of the protocol. And now we've made a lot of gains in levels of CFCs in our atmosphere. Now, one thing we haven't talked about is the fact that CFCs had very long lifetimes.
Right.
So CFC-12, which we use in our car air conditioners, has a lifetime over 100 years. So the problem isn't going to go away fast, but it's going away. And we're finally seeing improvements in ozone.
Okay. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Paul, hang on here just a minute, because I want to bring another voice into the conversation. David Victor joins us now. He's professor of innovation and public policy at the School of Global Policy and Strategy at the University of California, San Diego, and co-author of Fixing the Climate, Strategies for an Uncertain World. David Victor, welcome to you.
Meghna, it's great to be with you.
Okay. So is it even the right question to be asking about whether or not there are lessons to be learned from, you know, global efforts to protect the ozone when it comes to thinking about modern-day efforts regarding climate change?
Oh, I think absolutely it's the right question. It's the right question for at least two reasons. One is climate feels a lot like ozone. There's a lot of science, huge consensus, kind of growing pressure to do something about it. Not entirely clear what to do. It's very similar to the early days of the ozone policy discussions. I think the other reason is that the ozone accords, which are so successful and at the time were already known to be likely to be quite successful, they were really the model, or people thought they were the model for what we were trying to do with climate change. And so the model ended up kind of going wrong and not being applied in the right way. But I think that this is a really, really important discussion to be having today, not just because the ozone layer is getting better, but because climate change is still there and we need good models.
Okay. So let me ask you, though. It seems to me that one of the big differences that Paul actually described is that there were relatively quickly ways to replace the CFCs that the Montreal Treaty was seeking to eliminate. And also, one might be able to describe the CFC problem as more narrowly defined, because it's not necessarily that, you know, entire economies depended on CFCs to function. So in that case, was the ozone problem perhaps, I don't want to say simple, because getting the world to operate together on anything is a challenge, but a more easily graspable one to solve?
I think it was it's an easier problem, but the difference is it's also easy to overstate the differences. The ozone problem is caused by lots of different chemicals. We've been talking a lot right now about chlorofluorocarbons. In addition to chlorofluorocarbons, there are halons, which are used in fire extinguishers. There's methyl bromide, which is used as a fumigant, especially in developing countries. Some of the chlorofluorocarbons were used for highly specialized purposes, like special foams that were used in the space shuttle program. Some of these chemicals were used in those metered dose inhalers, the things that asthmatics and others use to inject drugs into the lungs, of vital life-saving functions. And so there were some applications where it was easy, chlorofluorocarbons in spray cans. We had already in the United States switched those out long before the Montreal Protocol. Many other applications situations where it was much harder. And as you and Paul said a little bit ago, at the time, chlorofluorocarbons and other ozone-depleting substances were pervasive in the economy. They were literally everywhere. And so people didn't really know how quickly can we remove them. And what the treaty did is it really focused a huge amount of public attention and industrial action on what do we do about this? How do we learn which of these applications can be switched out quickly, which are going to take more innovation? And that learning process or experimentalism, as Chuck Sable and I talk about in the book that you mentioned, Fixing the Climate, that experimental process was really put on steroids by the Montreal Protocol starting around 1987.
Okay, so David Victor and Paul Newman, stand by. We're going to talk a lot more about the lessons that we can learn from the success. Yes, let's call it a success in the world coming together to protect or at least stop the depletion of the ozone layer. So more in a moment. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
Smart journalism, fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And just a note about something we're working on for later this week. We're going to be talking about awe, as in A-W-E. So we want to hear from you. When were you truly awestruck? What was happening and how did it change you? What triggered that sense of awe? And for the times where, say, you're not having that once-in-a-lifetime experience, do you have a sense of awe in everyday life? Share your story by recording a message on our On Point Vox Pop app. If it's not on your phone already, just go to wherever you get your apps and look for On Point Vox Pop. That way you can send us your story in very high quality audio. Or if you want, you can also still, as always, leave us a voicemail at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Today, we are talking about the lessons we can and should learn from a successful endeavor by humanity, that endeavor being trying to protect, coming together as a species to protect the ozone layer. Earlier this month, the United Nations announced that in several decades, it looks like the ozone layer may be in a significant state of healing. I'm joined today by Paul Newman. He's chief scientist for earth sciences at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. And since 2007, he's co-chaired the scientific assessment panel to the Montreal Protocol. David Victor joins us as well. He's a professor of innovation and public policy at the University of California, San Diego, and co-author of Fixing the Climate: Strategies for an Uncertain World. Now, David and Paul, I was listening over the weekend to some lectures that Susan Solomon has given. And I mentioned her earlier as being one of the chief researchers that went down in 1986 and 87 for the United States to Antarctica on that NOAA expedition. And she talked about in her lectures about how you kind of need three things to really pull the world together to make major change when it comes to the environment. She talked about it. You need things to be personal, perceptible, and practical. She calls it the three P's. And I want to talk about each of them individually. First of all, the personal, meaning that people can literally feel in their own lives the impact of the environmental changes. So, Paul, let me just start with you. Can you remind us of the role that public opinion played in, you know, in the 80s in galvanizing support for what ended up being the Montreal Protocol?
Sure. I mean, a lot of you probably yourself know people who have had skin cancer. And that is a very personal thing that impacts people. In fact, the story was that, in fact, Ronald Reagan had skin cancer taken off. And so he actually recognized it. So the personal aspects of developing cataracts or getting skin cancer, that really grabs people's attention. And the second part of that was that when the Antarctic ozone hole first appeared, it's a picture, and people have the visible mental image of a hole in the ozone layer, allowing more UV radiation. Very personal for most people.
Mm. And I think you've also told us a story about, you also tell a story about how George Shultz actually went to President Reagan at the time and convinced him that this was a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, there was internal negotiations in the State Department. There was a lot of discussion at the highest level. I mean, Reagan and George Shultz. Unfortunately, George Shultz could actually go and talk to Ronald Reagan one-on-one. I think that was extremely important to advance negotiations.
Okay. So then, David, draw the parallel between then and now.
Well, then and now here is just extraordinary, because it's no question that the United States played a really central leadership role. There were big battles inside the Reagan administration about whether the U.S. should be doing this on ozone. George Shultz, who's one of my mentors, told me often about how important it was to be able to go directly to the president and to win that battle. And then the United States really led on this. I think that's a different story right now, where the United States leadership is kind of flakier. Sometimes we lead, sometimes we don't lead. The rest of the world's not quite sure if we're on board. And the reason leadership really matters here is because on climate change in particular, you've got to invest in new technologies and be confident that there's going to be a different future out there. We're laying the tracks for different cleaner futures. And if you know the biggest economy in the world is doing that, then it's a whole lot easier for a lot of the rest of the world to follow suit.
Okay, so then, I mean, this is a major difference then, right? Because go ahead.
Yeah, I think this is a major difference. I do think what Paul's saying about public opinion here is vitally important. All these international agreements basically don't have enforcement mechanisms. They have some enforcement mechanisms here and there at the side, but what really enforces them is public opinion, public concern. And here I think there are some really interesting parallels that resonate. There's a massive public concern about climate change, not across the political spectrum, but a lot of the political spectrum. And so you see a growing number of firms and governments that know they have to do something about this. They have to go find alternatives. They're doing exactly what happened in the Montreal Protocol in the early days of the ozone layer, which is we're doing the easy things first. So we're switching to renewables where they're less expensive already, and other things that we're investing in new technologies, like how do you make steel clean? That's hard, expensive, and so on. But that experimentation is underway right now. And a really big motivator for the experimentation is this concern that if you don't do things right by public opinion, that you're going to be shut out of the market or worse.
Mm. But when we say that public opinion is a key factor in galvanizing, you know, leadership, it's almost like this virtuous cycle here. Another difference between then and now is I would say that we have this major countervailing force of climate denialism coming from extremely wealthy, you know, corners of this country who are spending a ton of money to keep just enough doubt in there so that it remains a viable political position to hold in this country, David.
Yeah, I think it's not just this country. It's Australia has a big denialism streak, and the UK and so on. But I think it's also easy to overstate that. There's no question that there's a lot of denialism out there, and people maintain kind of crazy positions that are completely contrary to the science. But when I look at the polling data, what I see is maybe 10% or 15% of the country is not going to be convinced by anything, and it just doesn't matter how many chalkboards you pull out and how many equations you show them and so on. They're not going to be convinced. What I see, though, is something very different, which is there are different communities that are thinking about climate in different ways. Evangelical Christians are thinking about this as, you know, God's creation. How should you treat God's creation? People on the far left are thinking about it in terms of human rights and environmental justice. People in the middle are thinking about costs and benefits. And so what you need to do is put together and hold together a policy strategy that speaks across the ideological spectrum. And I think there's actually quite a lot of good news. We're starting to actually make quite a lot of progress.
Okay, so just let me ask you another quick question, then Paul, I'll turn right back to you. Was there in the 80s a parallel sort of resistance to the banning of CFCs, halons, et cetera?
Yeah, there was a resistance. There was famously, I think it was Donald Hodel who said, you know, if we lose the ozone layer, all we have to do is wear hats and sunglasses to protect us against ultraviolet radiation. Now, that was nonsensical, but I think that's exactly the parallel to be drawn out here, is that whenever you have one of these big shifts that people see as potentially scary to the economy and so on, that some part of the American public or any public is going to resist the change. And the key is to create enough of an incentive so that you can go off and demonstrate, here's what a new, cleaner future looks like. Here's why it's risky not to invest in that future. And then by changing those facts on the ground, you change the politics, and then it becomes self-sustaining.
And you're saying that happened with regard to
that happened in the case of the ozone layer. And it turned out that for many of those chemicals, it was easier than people originally expected. And so it accelerated, the action accelerated. But the same thing is happening now on climate change.
Paul Newman, what do you think?
Yeah, I totally agree with David. I would go around giving talks to folks, and I'd get calls from folks about ozone depletion, and a lot of the denialism is exactly paralleled. People claiming it was volcanoes, people claiming that CFCs were too heavy to get into the stratosphere. These were all easily refuted scientifically, but were widespread across communities in the U.S. And we, as scientists, spent a lot of time combating some of this denialism. It's a little bit exhausting to deal with a lot of this, because, you know, you start off with something nonsense and then you have to go way out of your way to prove it's nonsense. But I think in the end, it forces scientists to be a little more rigorous in how they describe the science and actually dot their I's and cross their T's a little more carefully. So denialism in the end was widespread. It wasn't, they were all incorrect, but I think it did force scientists to be a little more rigorous in their science, and that, in the end, was a good thing.
Mm. So, you know, I stand firmly in a place of optimism and the belief that under the right circumstances, we, being humanity, can do big things. But I'm going to keep pressing on, what might be some of the differences here, just to illuminate what could be hopefully our path forward. So one of the other P's in Susan Solomon's three P's was practical, right? There's just like a practical, understandable solution set for people to follow that then can be, you know, enumerated into treaties, et cetera. Now, from what I recall, and what we've been talking about, it was pretty straightforward regarding what needed to change to protect the ozone layer. It does, even though it does seem similarly straightforward regarding climate, David, I'm going to turn this one to you. It's not as rapid, right? Because, you know, we're talking about a decarbonization process that can't happen in, like, say, the 10-year span that Montreal laid out for CFC reduction.
Yeah, but I think it's also easy, looking back in history, to forget how little we actually knew at the time. Mm. So it seemed easy on the case of the ozone layer. But when you go back, and this is one of the things that Chuck Sable and I do in this book, Fixing the Climate, is we went back and looked at what do we really know at the time? What we knew was that the ozone layer was thinning, the hole was there, some experiments were done that decisively showed humans were to blame for the hole. But then we didn't know exactly how to switch out all the chemicals. And so what the treaty did is it didn't say, here are the solutions, go implement them. It said the exact opposite. It said, here are the goals, and go off and figure out how to reach these goals and come back and check in with us periodically, and we'll adjust the goals as we learn. The goals might get faster, or might get stronger, or might get weaker, depending on what we actually learn. And that process of experimentation, of search, then resulted in finding lots of chemicals that could replace chlorofluorocarbons. It found many applications where we could do without chlorofluorocarbons altogether, like cleaning circuit boards when after they're soldered. And through that learning process, we were able to ratchet the commitments tighter, and in some cases, we actually loosened them up. I mentioned a little while ago those drug inhalers. It took a long time to find reliable solutions for that, and so for a while, we relaxed the rules on those. I think what's happening now in climate is we're in that similar process of searching. It's just a whole lot harder because the degree of industrial disruption is greater, and so this is a significant difference between climate and ozone. But what's similar is the process.
Okay, so this is really important because what I want to hear from both of you is, what do you tell young people, especially now, because there's regarding climate, it seems like there's actually this, while there's a growing amount of passion and activism and movement to change, there's also a growing amount of what, you know, it's being called climate nihilism. You know, young people even saying, like, I'm not going to have children because why have, you know, bring a new generation of humans into a burning world? So, I mean, Paul, what would you tell those same folks who throw up their hands and say, we're never going to solve this climate problem because there are too many forces against it? What would you say to them?
Well, I'll go back. I'll take a step back. And it's because David made a couple of really good points here. And I think I'll just articulate one, is that the Montreal Protocol wasn't designed as an on-off switch. It was designed as an evolutionary agreement. In a way, you could think of it, we were going down a highway at 100 miles per hour in 1987. They signed the agreement. They did not stop the growth of production and consumption. They just slowed down. They went from 100 miles per hour to only 50 miles per hour. Okay, they were still going forward. They weren't backing up, but they were still going forward. But they slowed down. And in fact, it's the amendments to the Montreal Protocol as the science strengthened, as we found what caused the ozone hole. It was chlorofluorocarbons. We found the same thing going on in the Arctic. We found it going on in lots of places around the globe. The science strengthened, and the Montreal Protocol was strengthened in response to that science, and it was the policymakers and industry that acted hand in hand. That was actually a really essential agreement. Now, me personally, this is not a scientific opinion, but I gained a lot of confidence in the ability of industrial society to respond to environmental problems. I think the Montreal Protocol, not only has every country signed it, but we've made huge progress in finding technical solutions to chlorofluorocarbons and halons, and the hydrochlorofluorocarbons also. So I am a bit of an optimist, having been around this issue for more than 40 years now.
Well, I'm going to jump in here because I want to give David Victor the last word here. We got about a minute, David. Same question to you.
Thank you very much. I'd say two things. First, passion's incredibly important. It's what forces change in the industrial system. But focus that passion on finding solutions, because the more progress we make in finding industrial solutions, then the more rapidly we can ratchet forward these commitments. That's the really important lesson from the Montreal Protocols. It was science along with that finding practical solutions. The other thing I'd say is we're making progress. 15 years ago, we were on track for 4 or 5 degrees C of warming in this century. Now we're on track for 2.5 degrees. That's still a whole lot of climate change, but it's not 4 or 5, and that's the real measure of progress. And by that metric, I think it's actually pretty impressive how well we're doing, and we have to do, obviously, a lot better.
Well, David Victor is a professor of innovation and public policy at the School of Global Policy and Strategy at the University of California, San Diego, and he's co-author of Fixing the Climate, Strategies for an Uncertain World. Thank you so much for joining us today, David.
Thank you.
And Paul Newman, chief scientist for Earth Sciences at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, and since 2007, co-chair of the Scientific Assessment Panel to the Montreal Protocol. Paul, it's been a great pleasure to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.